Unreal Until Experienced by I Feel Better, read by Marianas for the Podfic Broken Telephone Challenge 2017. This is a Slings and Arrows fic, but it's set in the world of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, so it's modern day, but magic is very much a part of everyday life. "I'll have you know," the viper-taught woman said sharply, "that Oliver Wells would never have stooped to using a painted backdrop." Jeffrey pinched the bridge of his nose. He could hear the next sentence coming, and if he had bothered to watch her face, he would have seen her mouth start forming the words. Everyone said the same damn thing. At some point, he'd started living in a Sartre play, and he damn well wanted to get out. "Oliver Wells hired real magicians for this theater," she said accusingly. "Brilliant, exactly according to the script." "Thank you, Maria," Jeffrey shouted, landing too heavily on the first two words to sound entirely sane. "No one's mentioned that before. I wouldn't have known if you hadn't been good enough to inform me of it at this time. How wonderful for us both that I now know the error of my ways." Maria sniffed. Then she waited. Jeffrey made a sarcastic flicking motion with his hands, trying to encourage her to just walk away. She waited some more, lips pursed. "In case my sarcasm wasn't allowing my point to get across, let me be clearer," Jeffrey said, around gritted teeth. "I will not hire magicians for this theater." She sniffed again. He threw his hands up and slammed the rehearsal door behind him as loudly as he could. During his undergraduate education, Jeffrey signed up for a 2-hour Friday afternoon seminar called Safe Magic, The Do's and Don'ts of Enchantment in the Theater. He'd had the grade school version of Magic Safety, of course, the one where an MARE, Magical Abuse Resistance Education, officer visited the class of 6-year-olds and glowered ominously at them in an attempt to discourage them from attempting anything magical, because obviously you couldn't even trust a simple locating spell in the hands of a 6-year-old. But the MARE party line was a bit too hard and fast for Jeffrey's tastes, so he'd joined the school magic club sometime pre-puberty, competed in the regional hex races all the way through high school, and then double majored in magic and theater in college. But he took the Safe Magic seminar because no one had ever really addressed the concern that had been twisting away at the back of Jeffrey's mind for years. What about the theater? Because he was skilled enough at magic to recognize it when he saw it, and theater was filled with it. Magic spilled out of a theater like there was a fairy orgy going on in the middle of a witch circle set on the full moon in fucking Stonehenge. It had to be dangerous, right, to have that much magic running wild? But no, everyone acted like it was completely fine to have all that rampant natural magic lazing around the flashpoint of a halfway decent, because the money was good, but it wasn't rewarding work. Everyone knows good magicians don't do it for the pay, magician. Everyone looked at him funny when he suggested that maybe that was a bit like waving a flame torch around a couple of kegs of gasoline. So when he'd seen the flyer for the seminar outside of his applications of Norrell to theater lecture, he'd been thrilled. Finally, he thought, finally someone would talk about this whole gasoline thing. He'd sat in the front row, twitching his left knee in impatience, while the slightly pudgy man had tapped on his microphone a couple of times, looking fairly confounded by the technology around him and the sheer quantity of people who had shown up. It was an ominous start. The speech had been fine, no more, no less. It hadn't addressed any of Jeffrey's fears, but at least someone was talking about it. The disappointment and the relief basically canceled each other out. But then a gloved hand on the far side of the auditorium was raised in such a way that Jeffrey could feel the owner's disdain, even though he couldn't see any of the man beyond that ridiculously ruffled shirt sleeve. And then the lecture went to shit. "You'll have to pardon me if I offend you with the intensity of my language," the man with the glove and the ruffle said in a drawl that could have provided enough disdain to power a generator. "But I'm afraid the premise of this lecture is pure caveman hysteria, and frankly, I'm shocked anyone as backwards thinking as you isn't living in a log cabin and chasing kids off their lawn with a pitchfork." The pudgy man at the lectern pushed his glasses up his nose and blinked. "Was there a question?" he asked, hesitantly and politely. Jeffrey's left knee stopped twitching. "Oh," the man in the audience drawled. "I have a question, all right. My question is this. How do you propose to run a modern theater without any of the conveniences of magic? How would you do Lear's Storm, Prospero's Tempest, shake a sheet of tin? The audience tittered. I hadn't actually proposed, the pudgy man said nervously, his eyes darting around the room as the titters turned into giggles. So what if you did use a tin sheet? The laughter stopped. Geoffrey looked behind him to see who everyone was staring at, who had spoken, but then he realized. It was him. He had spoken. Oh well, in for a penny, as they say. So what if you did use a tin sheet for Lear's Storm? He continued. Isn't it Lear's job to make it real, not a backstage magic trick? I wasn't advocating a directorial position, merely advising precautions, the pudgy man said, too close to his microphone, holding his hands up in the universal position of, there's a shit show coming and I want to be out before it hits. Neither Geoffrey nor the man with the ruffles was willing to let him redirect the conversation quite yet, though. Surely you don't expect an audience with modern sensibilities to react with anything but contempt if Lear is howling away at a tin sheet, the man with the ruffles said, still out of sight. Surely you don't expect a good actor to need tricks, and Geoffrey hung all the scorn he possibly could on the word. To make King fucking Lear a tragic figure. I think we should return to the question of practical safety precautions, gentlemen, the lecturer said. I think I see a hand raised in the back. Geoffrey fumed in his seat for the remaining half dozen questions, and then stormed out before the host had finished thanking the pudgy man for taking the time out of his busy schedule to give this lecture. He turned around just outside, though, and finally saw the man with the ruffled shirt sleeve through the glass pane of the door. The man was watching Geoffrey, too. And that was how Geoffrey Tennant met Darren Nichols. Coincidentally, that was also how Geoffrey Tennant began his career as the only North American director who refused to use magic in his productions. He would eventually give thousands of interviews over his career about this eccentric position, and he would answer the question, "What prompted you to?" in a thousand different ways, not one of them the truth. The truth was, he started out of spite, pure and simple. He started because Darren Nichols had gotten under his skin. Ellen was waiting in his office with her feet up on his desk. Darren always outsells you because he uses a magician, she pointed out. No, he outsells me because there are flaming horses in Hamlet when he directs it, Geoffrey said, lifting her feet up so he could look for his notes on Paulina's studied torment speech from The Winter's Tale. He outsells me because I ask something of my audiences beyond the ooh and ah of cheap vaudeville tricks. Tomato, tomato, Ellen said, shrugging. She wagged the notepad in her hand. Damn, how come she could always find his notes before he did? My notes, Elle, he said in what he hoped was a stern, I am the director, you are the actress, I outrank you, tone. My point, Jeff, she said, dropping her voice into a deep bass, and it took Geoffrey a beat to realize that she was trying to imitate him. Was that an imitation of me or Don Pizarro? He asked, raising an eyebrow. She opened her mouth, and he continued, in the interests of keeping a boring conversation as short as possible. He's the bass role in Figaro. My point stands. It was a bad imitation. Magic, Geoffrey, Ellen said. You can't get an audience without it. Our Hamlet didn't have an ounce of fairy dust, and it did fine, he said. Our Hamlet didn't finish its first week, she said. That's unrelated, and you know it. Maybe I don't know that, you ass. Maybe you went fucking mad because you were Hamlet without magic, and you had to make up the difference, and it's fucking Hamlet, for God's sake. I am not talking about this with you, Geoffrey decided haughtily, and tugged his jacket out from under her with enough force that she toppled out of the chair. And I won't change my mind. He slammed the door of his own office. This isn't over, she shouted from inside. He rolled his eyes. Of course it fucking wasn't over. This shit was never over. Geoffrey's production of Romeo and Juliet in their junior year was the talk of the university. Everyone thought it was so risque. to stage an entire production without magic. They thought he was making a point, like the production of Hamlet Sarah Bernhardt had done in 1889, where she'd insisted on not conjuring a Norwegian army for her Hamlet to be watching in Act 4, Scene 5. They said Bernhardt's production was about raw emotion, that it was naked in its intensity. Oliver Wells left a note saying Jeffrey had a future in the theater. Pretentious as fuck, but Jeffrey kept the note folded in his copy of R&J to this day. But Darren fucking Nichols wrote a scathing piece about the production as an op-ed column in the school's paper. He used abominable, atrocious, and ass in one sentence, the alliteration alone making Jeffrey want to pull someone's hair out. But more than anything else, Jeffrey had been offended by the accusation that his Romeo and Juliet was a gimmick, a non-magic production just to see what a non-magic production would look like. He said Jeffrey lacked spirit. So Jeffrey did the review of Darren's Endgame and called Darren out on the fact that he had cast no actors and had instead hired a magician from the graduating class to simply animate lifeless chess pieces. He wondered how Nichols could pass the requirement of the junior project when he hadn't even staged a real production since he had no cast. He said Darren lacked spirit. 2 days later, Darren slapped him with a leopard print glove in the student center while he was buying a coffee. A week after that, they dueled in the quad. If Darren had expected Jeffrey to not be able to hold his own in a wizard's duel because he didn't want magic in his goddamn theater, he was disappointed. Jeffrey was top of his class in his magic major. Jeffrey, for his part, was definitely surprised that Darren, despite having hired a hack magician for his production, knew his way around a spell or two. That's how Jeffrey got the scar on his chin, and Darren got the one on his right thigh. How Darren says the duel ended. A triumphant defeat of the caveman, who never did know which end of the wand to hold on to. How Jeffrey says the duel ended. A puffed-up magic illiterate got his comeuppance and was floored by Jeffrey's boundless skill. The thing is, one director cannot direct two plays at once. Well, that's a lie. A director is fully capable of directing two plays at once. He would just have to use magic. It wouldn't be hard. Even Jeffrey knew the spells, right? To stretch out time in one rehearsal, to overlap the same hour twice, literally making a director be in two places at once. A lot of overworked directors did it. So the thing really is, Jeffrey cannot direct two plays at once. He had copies of both plays on his desk, and had a hand resting on each cover, index finger tapping in a haphazard beat back and forth between them. Whichever he didn't direct, some hack with a magician and a bag of cheap tricks would ruin. He could save the other, make it honest and brutal and fucking worth the price of the goddamn admission, but still. "This is like Sophie's Choice," he said to the empty room. "It's really not," said Oliver. He was perched on the windowsill and drawing circles on the window. "You're going to direct as you like it, obviously. You wrote that essay on it in high school. It won that award." "First of all," Jeffrey said, spinning his chair to face him, "it was a contest for extemporaneous speeches. There was no essay. And second of all, the fact that I was able to speak uninterrupted about a play for 15 minutes has nothing to do with the amount of affection I feel for said play. I could talk for 15 minutes about the choice of curtains in Hamlet, you know that." "I am," Oliver said, raising an eyebrow, "aware. But yes, fine, I feel a great affinity for As You Like It. Much more than you do for The Winter's Tale." "Yes, well," said Jeffrey, "no one feels an affinity for The Winter's Tale. Darren Nichols does." Jeffrey stopped spinning. "No." "Yes, he did an interview about it in 98. "No." Jeffrey tapped the finger on top of The Winter's Tale a couple of times. "What did he say?" "Damned if I know," said Oliver. "I'm dead. I can't be bothered to remember that sort of insignificant detail." Jeffrey spun the script in a circle on his desk. Jeffrey found the interview on YouTube. It had that grainy quality that old VHS interviews reformatted for the internet always have, a sure sign that it was Darren himself who put it online. But still. The voice off screen asked, "If you could have your pick of any play, which would you direct next?" Darren's sharp eyes flickered from the interviewer's face, which even Jeffrey knows was where your eyes ought to stay when doing an interview, and Jeffrey made it a point to know nothing about what you ought to do when doing an interview. And the camera, ever so briefly. It was like he looked directly out of the screen, across time, right at Jeffrey. "If I had my will, I'd direct The Winter's Tale from now until the end of time," he said, trying to smile pleasantly, but grimacing instead. "Oh?" the interviewer prompted. "Oh, yes," Darren said, and leaned forward. "Think about what Paulina says in that last scene. 'I am sorry, sir, I have thus far stirred you, but I could afflict you farther.'" Darren paused, dramatically allowing the interview to follow the instruction to think about it. "This is a play about affliction, not the kind you can explain away or think your way out of," Darren said, finally. "This is about inexplicable affliction, the kind that defies rationality, the kind that makes a man go mad." Jeffrey took a hissing breath. "Of course, this is also a play in which the porous boundary between literary and theatrical event allows a meta-theatrical commentary. Leontes, after all, is the critical observer of his own madness. The inexplicable nature of his descent into madness confounds him just as much as it does the audience," Darren continued. His glance flickered back to the camera. "His madness is inherently magical, inexplicable." The clip ended. Jeffrey chewed a razor blade, twisting it against his tongue. The nice part was that Jeffrey managed to drop Darren's name into a couple of key conversations without anyone noticing. This meant that when Anna came up with the idea to ask Darren to come in to direct one of the plays, Jeffrey could go through the usual motions of hating the idea of Darren directing anything. "He's not a director! He's a Vegas magician!" Jeffrey shouted. She looked unconvinced by his wrath. "Just pick the play," Anna said, not looking up from her desk. He went back to his office, slammed both doors, reopened them, and tossed her The Winter's Tale. "I'm agreeing to this against my better judgment," he said haughtily. She finally looked up, but just to raise an eyebrow. There had been a time, sometime between Jeffrey's third Tempest in a condemned theater and Darren's Doll's House in Japan, when they had ended up accidentally running into each other in a Starbucks just outside the Globe. And because this was how Jeffrey's life worked, they literally ran into each other. Darren was taking notes in a tiny moleskin notebook, one of the ones that has a slot for your tiny nub of a pencil so that you can be as utterly pretentious as it is physically possible to be, all while having great difficulty actually using the notebook to take any notes. Not that Jeffrey had thoughts on the subject. He personally had been distracted by the fact someone had drawn a heart on the side of his coffee, like this was a thing that adult humans did. So they'd literally walked into each other, and Jeffrey had just barely managed to not spill coffee all over both of them. It was the first time they'd been face-to-face since the duel. They'd spent a great deal of time maneuvering around parties and opening nights and whatnot. They had both gotten very good at putting a buffer between them to make snide comments to, and thus avoid directly insulting the other, which would lead to another duel, obviously. But there they were, just outside a god-awful production of Twelfth Night that, besides completely missing the point of the Malvolio plotline, also had the worst wigs Jeffrey had ever seen on a human head. "Were you at—" Darren asked, and then sniffed, like he was trying to find something neutral to talk about. "Yeah," Jeffrey said. He scratched his ear awkwardly. There was a long pause while they avoided looking at each other. "The wigs!" Darren said, rolling his eyes. "I know," Jeffrey agreed vehemently. "And they've utterly ruined Aggie Cheek. It's a travesty." "Oh, absolutely," Darren agreed. By the time Jeffrey had finished his coffee, Darren had shown him the notes he'd taken for the review he was writing. Jeffrey scoffed at the alliteration, they spitballed some more biting insults, and then suddenly they'd spent an entire afternoon together on a park bench. And then suddenly they'd spent the night together, too. But Jeffrey wanted to be clear, he still hated the man and everything he stood for. "Oh, darling," Darren said the next morning when Jeffrey made it clear, "the feeling has always been mutual." Kate came back to play Rosalind because Jeffrey called in the almost favor/friendship card. Her hair wasn't blonde anymore, it was back to the warm chestnut brown color. She looked happy. She always had, because she was the type of person who worked on that sort of thing, but it was somehow more striking now, like it had settled somewhere on her face. He couldn't really think of Acelia, so he took Kate out for lunch. "I don't want to make demands on your casting process," Kate said, before she'd even finished slinging her coat onto the back of the chair. I trust you to cast your Celia." Geoffrey handed her the soy latte he'd gotten for her. Not because he remembered it was her drink, but because he happened to have thought of it. "Celia and Rosaline have to have a real connection," Geoffrey said, waving his other hand. I think you need to be there." Kate nodded and took a sip of the coffee. She wrinkled her nose briefly, but took another sip without complaining. "I saw your Lear," she said. She had always been the one to mention the productions you didn't mention. "Your Cordelia was just..." She took a deep breath, like that finished the sentence. It sort of did. "Sophie," Geoffrey agreed, gritting his teeth. Charles's face, he couldn't think about that. "She broke my heart," Kate said. They both took a sip of their coffees. "You know, there's that one scene with you and Celia," Geoffrey said, musing out loud. "Rosalind lacks then the love which teaches thee that thou and I am one?" Kate nodded, encouraging. "She leaves everything, everyone, just to follow Rosalind," Kate smiled. "I know a little bit about that." Geoffrey wasn't really listening. "It's what I love about Celia," he said. "It isn't complicated for her. There's only love, and then everything else. Love on one side, everything else on the other. There aren't decisions to be made, not for her. She just... Yeah, Kate agreed. "No sooner looked, but they loved. No sooner loved, but they sighed." "Exactly," he agreed. "There are no pauses for conscious thought. She has to be all feelings, all..." He ran out of words again. "You know," Kate said thoughtfully, "I went to high school with Sarah." At Geoffrey's blank look, she clarified. "Darren's Juliet. We went to high school together." "Oh?" Geoffrey said. He'd been working lately on trying to seem interested when people talked to him about things that weren't theater. It wasn't really working. "She told me about that running around the building trick," she continued blithely. She waited a moment and sighed when Geoffrey's face stayed blank. "You could call her in." "To say hello?" Geoffrey asked, confused. "No, for an audition," she clarified. "Oh," he said. "God, she could be great." His imagination just went skipping away. He could see her as Celia. She'd be so sure of herself, so very Celia. And with Kate who could talk herself into feeling anything, Kate who needed triple opinions before she could act, Sarah would be all in the instant, all passions. "Wait. Hold on, I thought she was doing that TV show about the aliens," he said. "I thought that was a long-term thing." Kate shrugged. "Got canceled." Geoffrey sunk back into his seat. He had a call to make after this coffee. Darren and Geoffrey were hired as co-directors once. Stupidly, they both accepted. 2 weeks later, after all semblance of professionalism had completely dissolved, they learned their lesson. There is still, to this day, a crater where that theater used to be. Thankfully, the spell in question appeared to have erased local memory of the theater as well, so no one particularly missed it. Geoffrey gave an interview 3 years later, in which he laughed for at least 3 minutes uninterrupted, when it was suggested that he and Darren would be explosive if they ever worked together. "I want it in my contract that Geoffrey is never allowed to chew on razor blades in my rehearsals," Darren said to Anna, pointing at his contract. "Put it right here." Anna took the proffered contract. She wrote it in pencil. It wasn't legal, no, but she doubted she could legally put that in a contract and not have Geoffrey committed. Again. Darren nodded a condescending approval and signed the contract. "I was in Belgium, you know," he said. "They don't hire magicians in Belgium. You do your own spell work." Anna made a noise that she hoped conveyed some sort of mild interest in Darren's newest "They understand me there" speech. "I do my own spell work now," he clarified. Anna tried to come up with a polite way to respond. "Oh," was what she settled on. It was always a bit risky to let a director do spell work. They tended to get carried away. But Darren Nichols got carried away one way or the other. Maybe it couldn't hurt. And for all that Darren Nichols was famous for that Beckett production where the audience was turned into grains of sand for the first half, Anna knew that there was, for lack of a better term, something magical about his productions. "And I want a weekly preset meeting with Jeffrey," he demanded. "Put that in my contract, too." "Weekly," Anna said, frowning at the contract. "You want weekly meetings with Jeffrey?" "Yes," he said defensively. "You wouldn't understand the artistic advantages of conflict." Anna hummed noncommittally, but she wrote the note. "Shan't," Jeffrey said, aware that he sounded like a petulant little Lord Fauntleroy, but unconcerned by the resemblance. "As business director of this festival, I have the power to compel you," Anna warned. "And I know where you live." "Damn it, Anna, I'm not living in the costume department anymore," Jeffrey whined. "I rented an apartment this year, you know I did." She sighed. "I rented it for you," she pointed out. "That's how I know where you live." "Oh," he said, deflating. They glared at each other for a moment. "Weekly?" he wheedled. "Weekly," she said sternly. "Ugh," he said. "And no chewing razor blades," she added. "You can't." "I can, am, and will continue to tell you what you can and cannot do," she interrupted. "And you will do what I tell you to do because you trust me and you know whose side I'm on." "Ugh," he said again. In their first official meeting, Jeffrey internally referred to this series of meetings as "feelings with madmen." Neither of them spoke for the first half hour. They just glared at each other. "You're the one who had this written into your contract," Jeffrey said sullenly, finally. Darren raised an eyebrow. "You can't possibly think that's news to me." Jeffrey rolled his eyes. "I'm only saying, you made these meetings happen, and now you have nothing to say." He sank back in his seat. It was a posture he had taken to in his teenage rebellion years and never discarded. It seemed apt. "Mixed signals, that's all." Darren huffed, almost a laugh, but too sarcastic to count. More silence followed. "All right, I'll bite. How are you going to stage Leontes' madness?" Jeffrey asked, resigned. He could be gracious about this. He could. Darren smirked. "With magic, of course." "Madness might seem magical from the outside," Jeffrey said, trying not to grit his teeth. "But I can assure you that's not what it's like on the inside." "Well, you'd know about madness from the inside," Darren said, bluntly, but somehow not cruelly. "Maybe I want the audience to be on the outside, though. Maybe that's what I'm trying to do with this production. Make Leontes the inexplicable madness no one outside can possibly begin to comprehend." Jeffrey thought about it. Yeah, that could work. It would even... He'd seen that reaction. And it was impossible to explain what going mad had felt like, what it meant, and the whys and wherefores Ellen had never understood, no matter how much she tried to get him to believe it had been that for her, too. Hell, even Oliver didn't understand, and he was supernatural these days. Yes, he could see how it might seem like, how magic might be a good metaphor. "Fine, sure, maybe," he begrudgingly agreed. "But how will it work?" Darren grinned and dropped his notepad on the table. An hour later, when the scheduled meeting ended, Jeffrey had to admit he was impressed. Grudgingly impressed. Sarah and Kate were perfect together. It was everything Jeffrey wanted it to be, and a little more, because he thought Celia and Rosalind, the difference and the union, happened in the big moments. He thought Celia so easily abandoning her own father for Rosalind, Rosalind coming out of her safe disguise for Celia, he thought those were the moments that made them who they were. But it happened in such smaller ways. It happened, for instance, in the moment when Celia and Rosalind reappear in women's clothing in the Anna Ignoris' scene. Every time he'd ever seen it done, that had been a throwaway moment. The decision had already been made, after all, and nothing is left but the spectacle of revelation. But Sarah grabbed Kate's hand right at the edge of the stage, didn't look at her, didn't break the character's determination, and slightly squeezed. Kate, Rosalind, glanced down at their joined hands, and then took a breath, like Celia, Sarah, had just made it possible, had given her the strength she needed to finally rip the band-aid off, to stand in front of the men she'd been hiding from. No magic needed, just a simple gesture, one friend reaching out to another. Oddly, he found himself telling Darren about it in one of their meetings. Not gloating, not even taking credit for it, just telling him, one director to another. Darren thought about it, and nodded. It changes everything, really, he agreed. And such a tiny gesture, too. That led them to talk about Ellen as Paulina, somehow, and what Ellen had said about Paulina's anger. The problem was this. If Leontes's rage is a magical madness for which he bears no responsibility, what is Paulina's rage? It must equal Leontes's in depth, it must match it with every breath, but it also must stay rational and ultimately explicable. So you're saying that Paulina's anger is the claim of a rational reality on Leontes? Jeffrey asked. Sometimes working out Darren's staging was like trying to follow the steps in an incredibly advanced game of chess, or to decipher a coded message in another language. Though he wouldn't admit it out loud, the strategizing appealed to Jeffrey. Darren frowned. Paulina's rage is her own, he said. Leontes cannot own it. I wonder if it can belong wholly to two people. Jeffrey wondered aloud, and shrugged. Darren seemed angrier suddenly, possibly even sullen. He stood up and pointed toward Jeffrey. He may be the metaphor, but I'll be damned if I give the whole play over to him, he said haughtily. You're thinking like a fucking actor again and only seeing one angle. Darren stormed out of the room. Jeffrey wondered when he'd lost control of that conversation. But Jeffrey found himself standing in the back of the theater while Darren rehearsed the next day. He knew they were running the last scene. He'd asked Maria specifically and then paid her in cupcakes and cigarettes, not to mention that he'd asked. He stared at the back of Darren's head, wrapped in a glittery scarf today. He chewed on his bottom lip and tried to guess what Darren thought of the scene being acted in front of him. You're not subtle, Oliver said, appearing next to him. I'm exquisitely subtle, Jeffrey said. All the critics say so. You're subtle in your productions, I agree, but I think you spent so much subtlety in your directing that you ran out in life, Oliver said. That's absurd. Oliver shrugged. I no longer have a horse in this race, I'm just making an observation. I don't have anything to be subtle about, Jeffrey pointed out. I'm just a director, watching a fellow director at work. Nothing unusual about that. Oliver snorted. Oh, absolutely, he agreed sarcastically. You and Darren, that's all about different styles of direction. Absolutely, purely collegial. That's you two all over. Jeffrey stuck his tongue out at him. Oliver sighed and vanished again. On the stage, Leontes was saying, Proceed. No foot shall stir. Ellen, Paulina, looked at the statue, frozen solid. Music, she said, and the breath of the word exhaled like an oboe almost, like the room was an orchestra warming up, but somehow it was private and quiet. Awake her, strike. A hum of strings started under her words, in a deeper register than the oboe, unfurling like a yawn. But on the last word, on the glottal stop even, suddenly a high violin crashed through the lower hum. Just a brief glance across the notes. The hum continued, like a warm underbelly, stretching and purring. But the high violin, now joined by a flute, cascaded down and then back up again. "'Tis time. Descend," Ellen ordered the statue. The violin and the flute dropped through the scales, falling, and then back up again as Hermione opened her eyes. Dust fell from her eyelashes when she blinked. "Be stone no more. Approach," Ellen said, and held a hand out to the statue. Its head turned inexorably slowly, with clouds of dust moving around it. Ellen reached out a hand, and Jeffrey thought about that moment when Kate looked down at Sarah's hand the day before. Darren was right, he suddenly realized. This isn't just Leontes's curse, is it? His madness, his rage, his sin, it isn't just his. This was Paulina's loss as well. Jeffrey tried to find Darren in the audience again. He didn't know whether he wanted to grab his attention or just to see what Darren looked like just then, just to check. But Jeffrey found that Darren had twisted around in his seat and was watching him instead. If Jeffrey had directed Winter's Tale, he would have explained away this moment. He would have told Ellen that Paulina was exacting revenge against Leontes, that she was stealing what he loved to punish him for not cherishing it. He would have told Hermione that she was waiting all these years, locked away like Rapunzel, until Leontes atoned. That the fact that she was punishing herself was subsidiary to the fact that she was swallowing her own pain to punish him. But Darren's version was better. Hermione was the statue, and the statue came to life, simple as that. Stone breathed, music made flesh out of rock, and a touch brought back her soul. Paulina wasn't having tea every Tuesday with a woman she hid in her basement, forcing them to wait on a man's arrogance. She silently watched pure stone and poured her grief around it. And she waited. And it wasn't Leontes' kiss that brought life to stone. It was that touch of Paulina's hand. It was the same gesture from when Celia reached out for Rosalind. A touch to let the other know that everything can be all right. It was better. Jeffrey must have said as much with his eyes, because he could tell Darren knew. But it took him another moment to smirk back. It was like his face had to adjust slightly, to match a feeling it didn't know how to express, before it settled back into old habits. Jeffrey could understand that. Darren gave Ellen the note later, backstage, in the hallway where Jeffrey couldn't hear. "There's a moment, in Jeffrey's As You Like It," he began. Then he told her about the way Celia moved for Rosalind's hand, the way hers had moved for Hermione's. And then he said something he didn't want to say. "There's magic, yes, but Hermione comes to life because you love her," he said bluntly. "It's not a spell, it's real." Ellen nodded. There was some drama with Anna and a board member. Neither Jeffrey nor Darren particularly cared about the business side of things, especially not since Anna had worked her coup d'etat on Richard, so neither paused to listen to the explanation. But the long and short of it was that Darren's Winter's Tale was set to open without previews. He'd yelled for a while at Anna, and then she'd locked him in a closet for a couple of hours until he promised not to blame her for things she had no control over. Then he told Jeffrey, and he'd spun it. Jeffrey had known the spin for what it was, but it didn't matter, it was a valid point, so that Jeffrey ended up locked in the green room and was forced to make a similar promise. So opening night was the first time Darren's production saw an audience, and an audience saw it. Perhaps they should have predicted this would end badly. Everything always did in the theater, after all. Jeffrey sat in the second balcony because he didn't want anyone to see how rapt he got. He recognized this was a losing battle. Oliver had told him as much. But still. Pride. A man must have his pride. "You're ridiculous," Oliver had told him at the coat check. "You're ridiculous," Jeffrey hissed back. It earned him a confused stare from the coat check attendant. "Not you, obviously." He turned his back on the increasingly puzzled attendant and went to find his seat. The production was beautiful. Even Jeffrey had to admire the spell work, especially with the bear. And then it all went pear-shaped in the last scene. When Paulina reached toward the statue's hand, the moment flesh touched stone, something went wrong. Jeffrey had the distinct impression that the world folded inwards, collapsed on him with a gentle creak. "Oh, shh," he began to say, but then everything went black. "Haven't I always said?" he demanded when the universe realigned itself. He hadn't opened his eyes yet, but he'd never been a man who needed an audience for his monologues. "Haven't I always said? Theater has too much magic already. It's dangerous. I always said, didn't I always say?" "Yes, yes, God, you're the cleverest girl at the ball," Darren said from somewhere underneath him. "Now, could you get off me?" Jeffrey opened his eyes. And yes, he seemed to have fallen on top of Darren. He sat up. Darren groaned. "That was my lung you just sat on," he said, elbowing Jeffrey in the thigh. "Sorry," said Jeffrey, and he shifted to the right slightly. Darren sat up next to him. "Oh, God," he said. "Oh, shit," Jeffrey agreed. They were looking at younger versions of themselves splayed across the sidewalk in front of them, each holding a fencing sword limply in one hand. And it was definitely their campus, their undergrad campus, and this was definitely not the present. "It's the duel," Darren breathed. "We've gone back in time to the duel." "Huh. No wonder I've never been able to remember who won this duel," Jeffrey said. "You told everyone you remembered it," Darren said sharply, his tone and eyebrows a parallel accusation. "I think you wrote an op-ed about it." "Yes, well," Jeffrey said, "I lied," Darren said. "Me too." "But, more importantly, I was absolutely right. Your production accidentally sent us back in time because..." "It's dangerous to use magic in theater," Darren recited in a sing-song. "Second verse, same as the first." "I'm just saying, I was right all along," Jeffrey said solemnly. "Stop rubbing it in," Darren said. They both looked at their unconscious younger selves. Both were skinnier. They had that much in common, at least. "I lost that vest in Budapest," Darren said sadly. "It has a fringe," Jeffrey said, trying to politely convey the utter absurdity of mourning that loss. "And it's mauve." "I miss that vest," Darren said, ignoring him. "Forget about the damn vest," said Jeffrey. "How do we get back to the present?" "We can't recreate the performance. We're missing all the key components," Darren said. "And we can't risk meeting ourselves, right?" "Probably not," said Jeffrey. "It would probably screw with continuity." "Yeah," said Darren. "So we should probably..." Jeffrey trailed off. Nothing sprang to mind. "I have no idea," Darren agreed. They watched their unconscious other selves again. Then Jeffrey had an idea. "Okay," Jeffrey said suddenly. "If this is right in the middle of our wizard's duel, then there should be a lot of ambient magic, right?" "Yes," Darren agreed. "I don't see where you're going with this." "I think we can recreate the circumstances of the performance," Jeffrey said. The thrill of trying something new temporarily drowned out all other considerations. "In place of the magical aura created by the audience's willing suspension of disbelief, we'll use the ambient magic from the duel." "To do what?" Darren asked. He obviously had not majored in magic when they were undergrads. If they'd had the time, Jeffrey would definitely have paused to point this out, and maybe point and laugh while he was at it. "We need to produce a moment of theater that is completely emotionally authentic and magical," Jeffrey said, jumping to his feet. He held a hand out to Darren and pulled him up. "Best of both worlds." "You went insane the last time you tried to act," Darren pointed out. "That was unrelated. I keep saying that, but no one listens." "Are you going to go insane again?" Jeffrey glared. It's a valid concern, Darren protested. Jeffrey sighed. It's always a possibility, he admitted. Let's just say this. It's not more likely that I'll go insane again. Darren shrugged. I think I should be Paulina, he said, switching topic suddenly. Jeffrey blinked again. Why? Darren shrugged. Jeffrey was pretty fluent in the variety of scoffing gestures Darren had in his arsenal after a couple dozen years of being the target of them, so he recognized this shrug as something a little more nuanced than the last one. It has to be emotionally authentic, he warned. Darren glared. I did understand what you said the first time you said it. I do speak English. It's just, Jeffrey said. He scratched the back of his neck awkwardly. You have to actually, you know, love me. Darren rolled his eyes. You cannot be this dense, he said. That won't be a problem. Jeffrey blinked in surprise. What? He asked stupidly. Darren waved a hand dismissively. It's why it makes sense this way. You just stay very still and think about how much you miss Ellen. That should get you to Hermione's headspace about Leontes, or, well, close enough. What? Jeffrey was repeating himself. He knew that, but the question needed repeating. Oh, shut up, Darren said. What? No, Jeffrey said, and it was only about 85% pure instinct that made him disagree with Darren on principle. It's not a pop quiz, Jeffrey, Darren said, folding his arms. Just lie back and think of Shakespeare. I'll get us out of this in a flash. Darren manhandled Jeffrey into position and slapped his hand when he tried to protest. Then Darren closed his eyes and muttered the spell, the one he'd used on Meg to freeze her in stone. The sensation wasn't bad. It wasn't what Jeffrey had expected, though to give him credit for expecting to be turned into stone for a theatrical exercise in an attempt to time travel would be giving him more credit than he deserved. But if he had given it thought, he wouldn't have imagined being turned to stone to be quite like this. It felt unexpectedly like, well, it felt like what it had felt like to come back to himself long ago, when he'd been stretched thin, stretched painfully across the entire world, for years, until he was mad with it. Only something as rigid as this could stitch him back together. It felt like what learning to be sane, or rather, what learning to look sane had felt like. It felt like not feeling. It clarified things. It meant he could focus on Darren, slowly, carefully, the way he couldn't get himself to focus on anything but Shakespeare, usually. It meant he had all the time in the world to wait, to think. But Darren was speaking. Shouldn't Jeffrey be listening? Music. Awake her, Darren said. The music, the fairy orchestra, the oboe, the skittering violin, all started up again. Jeffrey had loved the music before, in the rehearsal, and now it curled his stone toes. Come, I'll fill your grave up, Darren said. Stir, nay, come away. Come, I'll fill your grave up. The line repeated itself in Jeffrey's head. Why had he not noticed it before? Would Paulina, was she offering a trade, or can a death be traded for? Can a grave be filled without a death? Would Paulina, would Darren, would anyone for anyone else? And there was the moment, the brush of Darren's hand on Jeffrey's stone one. And there was the thing Jeffrey had always called going mad. There it was again. There was that feeling of being stretched so far that breaking was easier than keeping himself together. But it wasn't that, either. He blinked, the clouds of stone dust fluttering away from his eyelashes. And he was back in the theater, back in his seat, back in the present. God, was it really that simple after all? Somewhere, much earlier, Darren woke up before Jeffrey. They both still had their swords, Useless, really, for a duel with spells, but they both had a theatrical streak a mile wide, didn't they? He propped himself up on his elbows and looked over at Jeffrey. He thought, what an annoying little shit. And then he smiled. The end.